this Cola guy I'm telling you about. Would you believe it? He makes as much money as me.
Then he must be twice as smart as you.
From the KKFI studios in Midtown, it's time for Khadija and the White Guys. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Khadija and the White Guy. I'm Keith Washburn.
And I am Khadija Hardaway. Toot, toot, baby.
There's our toot, toot. And this morning, we are very pleased to have G.S. Griffin with us. There is a book called Racism in Kansas City. He wrote it, and he's white. So, good morning, Garrett.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, I just want to read the back of this book real quick. It struck me. White Kansas City was an entirely different place, a Jim Crow town that nearly ate my heart out as the years went by. Schools, hospitals, churches, theaters, and just about anything else were as thoroughly segregated as anything in Memphis. In its feeling about race, Kansas City might as well have been Gulfport, Mississippi. That was on the back of the book by the late Roy Wilkins of the NAACP. He was the director at that time, long time ago.
Yeah, he was also the editor of the Kansas City Call.
Yeah, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he went from here in Kansas City to the head of the NAACP.
Cool. Well, let's get right into this. What would make a 28-year-old white guy want to write a book about racism in Kansas City?
Sure. Well, there were really two motivating factors for me. One was a desire to study the topic, an interest in studying Kansas City's black-white relations. Mm-hmm. And the second one was kind of a desire to change white thought in some way, simply because there are, you know, modern conditions in Kansas City and in America as a whole, that I think white people look at in a, you know, not all white people, but some white people look at in a inaccurate way. Specifically, if we're talking about things like disproportionate black poverty, black crime, the racial performance gap in schools, and those sort of things, those sort of modern problems are blamed on, you know, something being wrong with black people, mm-hmm. you know, through the stereotypes, the typical stereotypes of laziness and immorality and aggression and deviancy and all that sort of thing. So what, you know, what I wanted to do with this book is to provide the historical and sociological context for Kansas City to, you know, to explain these sort of things.
So this is a truth-seeking book. So if someone is Absolutely. Looking to know the true history, which is ugly,
it is
not really pretty
it's
at
very
all,
dark.
Then they would turn to this book.
Yeah. It's primarily written for, you know, a conservative white audience. I mean, I want everyone to read it, obviously, but it is its purpose is to change the way people think by giving historical background.
Okay, so at 28, how did you go about gathering all the information that you needed? Because as I look at this book and I look at the timelines, I mean, you started in the 1800s.
Yeah, yeah.
To the present day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you go about gathering all of this information and putting it in this
Good
book?
Question.
Sure. Well, my primary sources were found at mainly the Kansas City Public Library's special archives, the Missouri
Kansas
Valley
City.
Collection.
Wait a minute, y'all. The Kansas City Library, y'all, is a very popular place. If y'all don't know it, you should introduce yourself to the library.
Absolutely. But also places like, UMKC's archives, the Black Archives, they have online files. And basically just going to different library systems, not just the Kansas City library system, but Mid-Continent and so on, that have, you know, you can just find treasure troves of journal articles and diaries and poems and photographs and all that sort of thing.
Right. My thing is that could be very time consuming. Did you chart this in a way that you went from 1800 to 1865 as does the book projects? And you went in a timeline and you started your research that way?
I didn't.
Or you just kind of winged it and it all kind of naturally came to you what you should do with it?
Yeah, I didn't write it in the order that the book was,
which
you know, finished.
Yeah, okay.
I think I started on, you know, the 1950s and 60s. The secondary sources, you know, those are my primary sources, and the secondary sources are, you know, fantastic works that already, you know, have existed for a while, like Charles Coulter's book, Take Up the Black Man's Burden, Kevin Gotham's book, Race, Real Estate, and Uneven Development, A City Divided by Shermer, and a recent one from 2014 was Pulled Over, which was by KU researchers who looked at who's pulled over in Kansas City and why. And so combining the research, that the scholarship that had already been done, with the primary sources that I was able to dig up from, you know, corners of libraries, everything kind of came together.
The reason why I ask that is because typically if you're talking about Kansas City history and you start talking about the truce line, that's more of a present thing, and people usually want to dig deeper, find out what it was or how we became what we are. And we know that the truce line has some significant history. I mean, it used to be a slavery plantation going through it at one point, you know. And so from there, it just changed and it evolved. So that was really the reason why I asked that question, was really to see what jerked you into this book, like just immediately. I mean, I got your answer that you're 28 and this, but there had to be some kind of fire, because this is not an easy topic to tackle. Mm-hmm. I have quite a few white friends who understand what black people are going through.
I'm hoping I'm still one of Khadijah's white friends.
Of course you are. But the thing of it is that some people get it and some people don't.
Yes.
And the ones that typically get it get ridiculed for getting it. And so at 28, you know, with such a drive, was there any ridicule along the way for you writing this book?
Good
and
question.
Putting the true information out there?
Well, I think that the internet is a great place for the typical racist bile that, you know, you run into when you do something like this. Most of my friends and family were very supportive of the work. Even though, I mean, like what you were saying, you know, people think in different ways, but can change over time. I feel like I have, you know, I grew up in the very white, you know, lily white suburbs of Johnson County.
You look lily white.
Yeah, I am lily white. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and lily white is not just, as Khadijah said before, Keith is really, really white. But, you know, lily white, I think, refers to
a whole
new
level.
Exactly. It's sort of a social construct as much as anything, right? So he's in Johnson County, which most of us think of, oh, yeah, there's a whole bunch of people down there that have no idea about racism.
I was one of those people. Yeah.
When I was saying it, I'm just looking at you as being white. So that's what I mean. I was just joking. But, you know, it's the same type of thing when people call white girls valley girls. Or, you know what I mean? It's that same type of concept. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I went for so long, for so much of my life, not thinking about race at all. I mean, that is, white privilege. You know,
I was about to say, that must have been sweet.
Yeah. It's, you know, white people do not have to think or talk or, you know, be remotely connected to race any way if we don't want to.
Unless you interject yourself into like a biracial marriage or
adopting
black kids or something of that nature.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and so when I was growing up in these, you know, white neighborhoods and white schools, and I never had to think about race at all, and I basically, you know, was just kind of ignorant. I wasn't woke, as the, you know, saying goes, until it was in college, you know, the senior year of college, that I started reading these, you know, works that changed my mind about so many things, Howard Zinn's books and later books by, you know, on race. I read as much on race as I could because I kind of got hooked on it, you know, and I got hooked on social justice. And so I would read, you know, white authors like Tim Wise and John Blasingame, and then black writers like Malcolm X and Cornel West and Michelle Alexander. And so after, you know, 4 or 5 years of just reading as much about race as I could, I started getting interested in Kansas City's history.
Did it anger you as you read those books?
Oh, yeah. And that's what, you know, that's what history is and should be, is it should anger you enough to, you know, do something about the legacy of this history today, which is why I'm, you know, an activist now after this, you know, journey of study, particularly on race, but a lot of other issues too.
And would that be where communities create opportunity comes into play?
I work at CCO, Communities Creating Opportunity, but I'm also involved with Stand Up KC and Surge and other social justice groups around KC.
I've heard a lot about Surge.
We're going to have Surge on. In fact, they have regular meetings, and I went to one of them. I mean, they have a huge crowd. This is not like 10 or 20 people. They'll have 100, probably 150 people.
I have a friend.
And they're mostly white because that's what the group is for, stand up for racial justice. They're saying to white people, much what, you know, Garrett is saying, is like, hey, let's wake up here. You know, racism is a real thing, and we need to acknowledge it, and we need to all do something about it. It's not, this isn't just black people fighting the fight. We need to all get into this and understand white privilege and all be part of this, so be part of the solution.
Right.
And we may not have as many police killings. Maybe it took the police killings, I hate to say this, in order to wake people up. But it's been going on, as he says in the book, it's been going on a lot longer than just Ferguson, Missouri.
My God. The police were designed for the control of African Americans after slavery. And it has never changed. The branding has changed, and that's for it to be subliminal. But the police department has always been there to keep black people in check. It may not have said that in the bylaws, but they sure act on it. If you are listening to us on the radio and you want to be a part of this conversation, you have any questions for the young man Garrett here, give us a call, 816-931-5534. Remember, if you are tuning into Facebook Live or Instagram, that you have to have your radio on in order to hear the caller. While we're waiting on callers to call in, why don't you give us a little bit more information about this book, how people can obtain it?
Sure. You can find it at Prospero's Books, which is on 39th Street. You can find it on Amazon. Like you said, the book starts at the year 1800, goes all the way to today. It's kind of a unique book in that there aren't any Kansas City books on racial history that look at the slavery or Civil War era. And the other works don't look at what happens after, you know, the 1960s, except for Gotham's book, which looks at specifically housing, or Pulled Over, which looks at specifically the recent years of, you know, police abuse. And so my book starts at the slavery era, goes through the Civil War, goes through the bombings of black homes after the Civil War, the lynchings. It goes through the civil rights movement, the Black Panthers here, Dr. King's visit here. It goes through the race riot of 1968. It's the only book that looks at the 1968 riot. And then it's after effects, you know, through the 70s, 80s. And then it looks at the current problems of, you know, police brutality, police harassment. And then, of course, the legacy of Jim Crow that we have here today in terms of poverty and schools and still segregation in where people live and work.
I want to say to our folks out there listening, this book is a great book. So if you're thinking like, well, what's a white guy know about racism? He has done a lot of research, and there's a lot of history in here that people are not aware of. In fact, Alan Brooks said this should be required reading of every kid in Kansas City, all school districts, everybody. In fact, it's in Hickman Mills School District right now.
Before we take the caller, is this book available on audio?
Not yet.
You ought to read the book.
I hope to make it soon.
And make it an audio book. But we have a caller. State your name, what part of town you're calling from. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Raymond.
Good morning, Raymond.
Good morning, Raymond.
Good morning. And I'm in Nolan Road and 40 Highway. And so, therefore, I'm going to turn my radio down. So I'm getting an echo.
Okay.
I know about racism. I'm born and raised in Kansas City. And what I understand about racism is that black people have been denied to start their own destiny, to create their own jobs, and build their own communities. Every time that we have been able to start, it's been denied in such a way that there's been mass killings or just recently, just for an example, Leon's supermarket, the only black supermarket we have in Kansas City, he tried to, was going to buy the store on Linwood and Prospect, and the wholesale grocers refused to sell him the products, although he was already buying them from them, because they already had plans to have a white structured company to come in there. And so now they are about to open up a grocery store for a black community. And that's racism, I mean, in its not infancy, but it's alive and well, you know?
Well, we've had several black developers who have tried to come along and put a grocery store there and have been blocked at several different angles. So I definitely agree with your take on that. I'm not for sure. I have not seen that in the news as far as the wholesaler is not willing to sell.
It was in the Kansas City Call, so it's public knowledge.
Well, I'm only asking for that so that I can go look at that myself, because that's a very interesting story. But
yeah,
it is something I definitely agree with you on. I mean, we had another black grocery store not owned by black people, but in the black community, where many black people used as their one source for groceries, and that's right there at 47th and Truce, the old Apple Market. Yeah, you know, it wasn't the best grocery store, but it was feeding people in the community, and now they have to filter out and find groceries some other kind of way, which is a very ridiculous sight, if you ask me. So
as long as we can't control our food, clothing, and shelter, and even transportation, we are still bound, you know?
Yeah, good comment.
Well, thank you for your comment, Raymond. You want to speak to me?
Thank you for being there. And what's the name of the book, and where can I buy it?
Yeah, the name of the book is Racism in Kansas City, and it's available at Amazon. And as Garrett said, Prospero's or Prospero's books. They're at 39th and where are they?
In State Line.
Yeah, 39th and State Line. That's a local bookstore really doing a lot for Kansas City. So, you know, not a bad place to buy.
I used to do hair over in that area. It's a place called Hairstyles. It's like 40th over in that cat corner. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the most remarkable thing, other than the thoroughness of this book, because this could be a textbook of a class, you know, or every class high school should have this book, is that he wrote it, and we're talking like he's 28 because he is 28, but he actually wrote it when he's 26, 27 time frame. So, you know, I just think that's remarkable. When did you first start the journey? Khadija kind of alluded to this earlier. Like, you wrote the book 26, 27, but when do you think you made the aha moment? It's like, all right, you know what? I'm going to do something about this.
It was about 5 or 6 months before Ferguson, actually, that I began researching, because I was kind of, you know, this writer who was looking for, you know, what his first, you know, project and book would be. And at the same time, I was starting to study Kansas City, you know, history. And when, you know, Ferguson happened, then I realized that this, you know, might be a book that, you know, a lot of people would be interested in, because that incident really changed the, you know, the narrative on race and had a renewed, you know, a renewed narrative.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When it comes to understanding, and you go out and I'm assuming that you speak mostly to white crowds.
Mostly, yeah.
Okay. And you get people to get an understanding that they have a lot of privilege.
Yeah.
How do you get people to exercise outside of their privilege? Because I find that a lot of times people are aware, but because they're creatures of habit, or it's easier to be in the situations or the way they in their privilege, that they don't come out of it, that it just reflects regardless. Even though they speak and say, I understand, actions still point to them not understanding. What do you give white people to create the habit of being outside of their privilege?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that I, you know, say is obviously you have to, like you said, become aware of the privilege first. And it's so deep, and you know,
because it's almost like a drug addict, you know what I mean? A person who does drugs, they have to somehow create a habit of not having that drug.
Yeah.
And they fall back.
And one interesting thing about white privilege that I find is just that, you know, in the white, you know, thought, it's kind of seen as, okay, well, you know, to prove that I have white privilege, you would have to prove that I got into this college at the expense of a black student, or I got this job because, you know, a black applicant was turned down. But white privilege is so much more than that, because, you know, you're simply divorced from any possibility of experiencing racism or, you know, mistreatment like that. So that's the first thing I say, is that it's not just, you know, it's not just, you know, proving did this happen to me. It's saying I am white, and therefore there's not even the possibility, right?
Mm-hmm. And understanding that.
Yeah, and really grasping that. And then once you can understand that, then you can start, you know, looking at a whole host of issues in different ways.
I'm just going to be honest. Most black people are not that in tune to white privilege as well. I mean, they know white people privilege exists, but they're more in tune to the suppression. It's not attuned to people, white people being privileged. It's more of everyday mechanism to fight it. Every day there is something that approaches an African American that they have to fight it. Right. And you guys say that's privilege. We say that's harassment in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? And so that's the nugget that I'm trying to understand, is that in your privilege and then outside of that privilege, it just seems to revert back. Right. And for African Americans, privilege really doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, your privilege is not going to make a difference to us dollar-wise.
Right.
It's not going to create a safe haven for us, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, white privilege is just another way of saying that racism still exists, for sure. And
right.
That's what a lot of white people don't understand.
But it really bothers me that we tackle the privilege so much and not the suppression.
Because that's a good point.
You can be as privileged as you want, and you're going to continue to be privileged. But black people will always be suppressed. And that's an easy way to just excuse out to me.
Right.
And that's my opinion.
Right.
And that's a honest and direct one. But I really believe it's something that needs to be talked about more in depth than just on the surface of, I believe you're privileged.
Right.
And what are you going to do about it?
Right.
You know what I mean? It should be, I see your suppression, so I need to do something about that.
I agree. 100%.
Yeah, I want to make the comment that there's another book that we had talked about before the show called Between the World and Me. It's written by a black man, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is a great writer. I think he used to write for The Atlantic. Is
still,
that right?
Still does. I believe.
Still does. Yeah. I mean, he writes some great stuff. But for the average white person, he probably is not as, you know, it's not the style of writing that a lot of white folks would even pick up.
Are they talking about Garrett here?
Nope, I'm talking about Ta-Nehisi Coates' book.
Okay.
It's a great book. I really enjoyed the book, but it is so raw that a lot of people just wouldn't be able to take it. This is a book that white people can access. That's what I love about this book, about Garrett's book, Racism in Kansas City, is you can read this. It's tough at times. It's tough to face that, this is what really happened. But it's a good book that is accessible by all people. That's why it would be a great book as a textbook in classes.
I'm gonna challenge you right quick, because what you just said a whole lot. The guy's book would not be able. Most white people couldn't handle it, and it's probably the raw truth. But to hand him something, and I'm not knocking your book or anything, that's more pleasant to read, still doesn't get to the nut, because you need to feel it as raw as we feel it.
You're misquoting me a little bit, but listen to this. Let's read part of the book here, and this probably isn't even the worst part of the book, but this is the beginning of the chapter that we talked about. What's the word that
the nadir,
which we didn't know what that means, but it means the dark period. It says, as the 19th century gave way to the 20th, the fear of blacks grew into an ideology that would dominate white thought for more than a century. It went beyond the fear of racial mixing and would damage race relations to an extent yet to be undone, meaning it's still going and it's tough. It's going to be, you know, hanging on. This ideology did not arise spontaneously. As with the birth of racism and the belief in black stupidity and inferiority, there were those who could profit from fear mongering. So he's saying that, you know, it's become, you know, the wide belief that, you know, blacks are inferior, et cetera, et cetera. Which I think that's tough to read, personally, is to think that we have taken a group of people and that we have beliefs about them based on the color of their skin, such as, you know, that they are inferior, and so on. But then he says it goes on. Now people can profit from the fear mongering, and that's, you know, start of a whole new era, which is, he's saying, is the darkest time.
But that's around the country, and that's just not in the instance of, you know, black people coming out of slavery. That's in the instance of retaliation. That's the fear that white people had. It wasn't more about their ignorance. That's a label that was put on us. But most slave owners were scared of retaliation for African Americans, and thereby that's where you get that policing in and all that different things. But to be terrorized because you held black people in slavery, talk about what you did to black people in slavery during those days. And if that the man's book that you referred to earlier is too hard to read, then that's just too bad.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of white people reading it. My friend Hannah has a book group, and all of her white friends, along with her black friends, are reading it as a group, which I think is a great way to read it, with people of color and white people to read it together.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, but if you cannot read it because it grosses you out, that's just too bad.
Right.
That's just too bad. It's the ugly truth.
They're very different books. I mean, Coates' book is so personal, and mine is obviously not, you know, I don't pretend anywhere to understand, you know, the black experience or to know what racism feels like. But Coates is, you know, the opposite. You know, he's a black man who's experienced, you know, a lot of horrible things. They're very different books.
When you speak upon a person that is African-American speaking of their experience, you're going to get the raw truth.
Yeah,
versus someone else seeing it through their eyes and they haven't experienced it. You're going to get that difference. Oftentimes, just going to put the truth out there, when you have a conversation of truth about slavery in the past 400 years, both white and black don't want to talk about it. It's painful for both. Mm. And that's the problem I see, is that both have an issue with it, not just white people. White people want to cover it by saying, let's talk about white privilege. Mm. And black people just don't want to talk about it because they're still living it. And if they talk about it, they could be murdered. That, quite frankly, they can be murdered. If they want to change, they could be murdered. And it's happening everywhere, no matter what you do. I mean, look at Black Wall Street. Those people were very capable people. They built themselves up by themselves, but then the government came and destroyed it.
So, yeah, and I'm not saying don't read the other book, because, as I said, my friend Hannah and her book group are reading it right now. And I've read more of the other book by Ta-Nehisi Coates. So I haven't gotten the copy. He just brought in the copy today. I read some of it that you sent me online. But Garrett actually was nice enough to bring us both a copy of his book. And I'm telling you, they're both good books to read. And this book right here, historically, I think is going to speak to a lot of people. I just really believe that. And Alvin Brooks believes that too. We do have a caller, if you're ready to take the caller. So you're on the air. What's your name and what area of town you're calling in from?
Yeah, this is Maurice Copeland. How you doing?
Hey, Mr.
Godfather.
Copeland.
Hey. I came in, excuse me. I came in late, but Khadija, you said something very important, that suppression and the oppression of us is really what's important. And the white privilege thing, I would love to talk about white privilege to anybody, any group. Somebody want to convince me that there's no such thing, please talk to me. We need this conversation, and we need it to be looked at by everyone. Don't be afraid of it, because it's facing us every day, and it's going to face us until we talk about it. White privilege is what keeps us retarded in so many areas: economics, job opportunities, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If somebody's going to come to say that this is nothing but a constructed phrase that really doesn't matter. Yes, it does. It matters in our everyday life. When you apply for a job where you know that if they're going to hire 10, well, that means one black. That's privilege, no matter how qualified the other people are.
Go ahead. Well, I just want to say something to you.
Go ahead.
If you're going to finish, but I have something to say.
Well, excuse me.
I want to say that white privilege is the birth of systematic depression, racism. is the cream that falls off of that. It is induced to white people because of the system. And just like it is induced because of the system, they have an obligation, and not just white people, all people have an obligation to change the system, thereby changing the privilege. Privilege is equated through the system. It's not equated through individuals. I'm sitting here next to Garrett, and I know this young man has probably been a great young man all of his life, and seeing people equal all of his life has nothing to do with his privilege. His privilege comes out of the fact that the system allows him to be and do whatever he would like without no grievance, without no checkpoint about it. Right. That's what it is. It automatically sees him as white, where it automatically sees us as black. White people need to step up to the plate and earnestly change the system. That's what it is. And we can't do it because we're shut out.
I'm so glad that you said that, Khadijah. It was a couple of weeks ago when I called in and I mentioned that the system needs to be addressed. And you couldn't figure out what the system was.
No, I asked you the question, not that I didn't know.
Okay, well, now you've mentioned it a lot, so now you know. What the system is. The system is of all things, the justice system, all systems to give that equal setting of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Let's look at it. Let's look at the privilege that has been given to white people all of their lives. Whether they used it or not, whether they felt it or not, it was there. At any point, and this is the way black people felt, this is the way I felt growing up, at any point a white person could be in a down situation, any point, and all they had to do was straighten up, and they would have a up on us in the same position. So, I mean, Lev, we need to talk about this, and this is a lovely subject. I appreciate it. It sounds good. Like I said, I came in late, but you got it going on. Keep it going on.
I just love how you took last week's words and just meshed them into this week. I just love that. You sound just like a real journalist.
Thank you for calling in, Mr. Copeland. We love Maurice Copeland. He's been one of the most loyal supporters and also, you know, calls in regularly. And on our Thursday night thing, he was there almost every week. So we love Mr. Copeland. So let's get back to the book. And we were going to kind of try to go through the book and, you know, go through just kind of the chapter by chapter, because it goes historically. And I'm guessing as you wrote it, I've never written a book, and it's intriguing me, and it seems to be intriguing Khadijah too, about, you know, just the process of writing a book. But I'm guessing that some of it is you start finding more things as you dig, and then you go, wait a minute, look at this. And so now this is a whole other chapter maybe. Is that the way it happens?
Yeah, absolutely. That describes it pretty accurately.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff that I wish I knew, but, you know, that I'm going to read. That's why I'm reading the book. And I'm daring every white person out there who says, I don't want to read that book, I'm daring you to read this book.
Well, hey, go ahead. On chapter one, we're talking about,
We've got a caller. We'll just have the caller hold for a second, please.
Slavery and freedom. And, you know, I already mentioned Truth Line being a slavery plantation. Does your book actually talk about the movement of the plantation and what happened? And does it at all mention Quindaro ruins and how it connected to that?
It does. It does. It mentions, I mean, Troost was a slave owner. You know, Benoist Troost, however you say his first name, was a slave owner, and that's how we got the name. And it does also discuss Quindaro and how that was a refuge or an escape into Kansas from Missouri across the river, yes.
During that time period, was it changed from the plantation into those nice big houses that you saw on Truth? Because my understanding, that was like the elitist row.
Yeah, it became Millionaire's Row. Yeah,
and you had your different people, your bank owners, all lived up and down Truth.
Right, it became that, sure. Over time.
And let's make this clear. We're talking about the white people on Truth. Is that right?
Well,
yeah.
Back then, there were no
millionaires
black people.
Weren't a lot of black millionaires.
Just for those that don't understand, because sure. Most people now would assume it's going to be black folks if it's on Truth. No, this was back when that was the area for the upscale you know, white elitist, yeah, as Khadijah said.
Does it talk about where the slaves came from? Because at the time, you know, they were coming from the South. And
sure. I mean, the slaves that, you know, came to Kansas City were brought from Virginia and, you know, and other southern states. As people started migrating west, they brought their slaves with them. Yes.
Okay, so caller, you're on the air. State your name.
Oh, we lost him, I guess. Call back if we, that was the busy signal as we saw there. So call back, please, caller.
Are there any remnants of what the slave plantation was like here on Truce Avenue? Is there anything that's left that depict any history?
Well, the book discusses the typical day in the life of a slave, whether male or female, whether in the fields or in the home, discusses the diet and the clothing and that sort of thing. The slavery chapter was probably the hardest, I would definitely say, out of the whole book to write, simply because not only is it so long ago, there aren't a lot of, you know, primary sources left, particularly from people of color and slaves who, you know, most who couldn't read or write. Mm-hmm. And so there weren't a lot of, you know, diary entries or anything like that that were left over from the time period to use as, you know, primary sources. So it mainly came from works that looked at not Kansas City, but instead all the counties around Kansas City. Mm-hmm. That's where the real research into that time period is. Specifically, Kansas City is a little harder to find way back then.
So if we could imagine what Truce looked like during the slavery era, if I could draw a picture in my head, what I see, and I'm going to use a landmark we have here right now, is Lee's Summit. Mm-hmm. Lee's Summit was just Cowtown, maybe, what, about 20, maybe 15, 20 years ago. And in some places, it's still Cowtown. You know, you run through and you see a pasture of cows still hanging around. So in my head, I imagine back then there were dirt roads, horse and buggies, with a mm-hmm. bunch of cows running around, running amok.
Yeah, sounds like a good visual.
I understand that there was an orchard on Truce at one time, a fruit orchard or something of that nature. But anyway, that just kind of draws you in to kind of look back at the 1800s. And then as we move forward, you know, it just became a residential area, right?
Yeah.
All that is in this particular chapter. Right on.
Sure.
And
what's interesting is just that, you know, Kansas City itself was very small for a very long time. You mm-hmm. know, it wasn't even an official city until 1850, you know, towards the start of the Civil War. There were, you know, only a few thousand slaves in Kansas City itself and, you know, not that many more, you know, white people.
So we have a caller on the air. State your name and what part of town you're calling from. You're on the air.
Okay. Yeah. Bear with me because I'm getting a little choked up. I'm sorry. I'm a white guy. I live out in South Kansas City. I'm 56.
Okay.
I want to know what I can do to help change things. I've been married twice. My marriage now. I'm married three times. I'm married to a black woman, and I've met my best friend and.
Oh, so you're a soul man.
What can I do to help? Because I mean, I'm talking about it. I want to be about it.
Hey, right on.
Great question.
Yeah, thanks for calling this morning. And you said, just to be clear, you said you're married to a black woman at one time, right?
No, now I'm currently. And,
oh, okay.
I've never thought. I've always known I've had privilege. And
did you grow up?
I never
in
have thought it was right. My mom brought me up to not be that way, and. It's just, yeah, it's messed up, and things are getting worse, and who we have in the presidency is just the scariest thing in my life.
Sir, can I ask you to do a favor? Can you call back
yes.
in and leave your information with my dad?
Mr. Kareem, yeah.
Toot-toot to my daddy answering the phones. And I will give you a call back. I have an idea for you.
Thank you so much.
You're
welcome. Hey, thanks for calling in this morning. Yeah, we do have another caller. Caller, you're on the air. What area town are you calling in from? What's your name?
Cruz, and I'm calling from Midtown.
Didn't catch your name.
Lavelle.
Lavelle, thanks for calling this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I turned in kind of late, so I didn't get the name of the book, and I was trying to, so I can go and read these to my kids and, you know, show them some of the history of Kansas City.
It's called Racism in Kansas City, A Short History by Garrett Griffin.
You said Griffin?
Yeah, yes. Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N. And he goes, his author name is G.S. Griffin. Garrett is with us this morning. And for those that are just tuning in, that's a good kind of little summary of what we're talking about. Racism in Kansas City. It's a book, 184 pages. It is a wonderful historical account. And go ahead, Lavelle. Did you have more questions or a comment?
No, that was it. And this said the show was awesome. I mean, I learn so much every day. You know, when you guys do come on and I tune you on as I'm at work and I listen and jot down different notes and different ideas, so I truly appreciate this show.
Well, hey. We truly appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks for calling
right,
in. We appreciate
the kind words. Toot, baby.
Toot, toot there from Khadijah to Lavelle. So, and we had another caller, I think, but if you somehow got cut off, we had one caller that either hung up or got cut off, call back for us. Let's go back to the book, because this book, it's not just about the early history. There's other things like, you know, it comes right on up to the present. So he's got
Let's
five
move
chapters.
Into chapter two, then.
Okay.
So, out of the war, 1865, 1890, going to ask the question that people don't think I know the answer to. Out of what war?
The Civil War.
Okay.
And the Civil War in Kansas City is described in about 9 or 10 pages in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks at, you know, not only the battles and such here, but how the institution of slavery fell apart here and how black soldiers were critical to the preservation of the Union.
So are you saying that the Civil War lasted for 35 years?
No.
No, that's just the time period.
That's
post.
The time period of what came after, okay. 1865 to 1890
and
is what
the
era
country,
after.
The country looked like then and trying to put itself back together.
Right, right.
The different sides coming together.
Yeah, more or less, but the immigration of newly freed slaves to Kansas City, actually most of them trying to reach Kansas, which was the promised land, so to speak, a lot of them ended up in Kansas City.
We do have a caller, but I do want you to answer a question about that. And
so we got a question kind of on hold. You want to go ahead and take the call?
Yeah.
All right, caller, you're on the air. What's your name and area town you're calling in from?
Hey guys, it's Jen.
Hey Jen.
What's up, girlfriend? Toot toot.
Hey, this is awesome. Love the show. Garrett, I'm going to get your book ASAP. I cannot wait to get my hands on that book. It sounds amazing. I just wanted to ask a question and I will take it off air. But as a white woman who is very in tune with white privilege and wants to use my life to do something about it, with all of the history that you've compiled in this book, just on an everyday basis, how do we get, as white people who are in tune to this and not okay with it, what are the first steps into really engaging the white community around us who just, they just don't, it's like they don't know at all. And one of the things I wanted to comment also was, you know, and I totally understand this, Khadijah, I can hear, like, the anger about the suppression in your heart, and it's valid. But I feel like my engagement with the white people as a white woman is it's like they're born into it. It's like so part of their DNA. They don't even know they have it. So how do you begin that conversation in a way that actually changes instead of calls out in a way that's aggressive? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, good question.
That's
all
great,
right, let's see
question.
What. Yeah, Garrett's got an answer. Hopefully,
sure. Well, I mean, the first thing that we have to do is start changing the frame of the conversation with other white people, and the way that we do that is we need to emphasize, you know, two things. First is the science behind racism, and the second is holding ourselves to the same standards that we hold other people. And when we talk about the science of racism, this is a very important thing that we need to teach other white people, is that racism can be measured in a scientific way, okay? So fundamentally, there are, you know, race researchers and social researchers who do experiments just to see what racism is like in this country or in particular cities. I'm thinking of a study that was done in Boston and Chicago, where race researchers, they took identical resumes, identical except for the names at the top. And the names at the top, some were black-sounding names and some were white-sounding names. I remember it very well because Garrett was one of the white-sounding names, right? And they sent these resumes out to job openings in Chicago and Boston just to see what would happen, right? And the names with the, you know, the black-sounding names, those resumes were 50% less likely to get the callback for the interview, right? That is the sign of a huge problem. This isn't a small problem. And so the scientific way that we go about measuring racism, that's something we need to emphasize to other white folk. The second thing being the...
I love that, folk.
Yeah. The second thing being that the holding each other to the same standards, right? When we talk about police shootings, for instance, a lot of white people do not hold the victims like Terrence Kutcher, Tamir Rice, Ryan Stokes here in Kansas City. We don't hold those folks to the same standard that we hold ourselves or our own children. I was in a conversation with a conservative white friend after Tamir Rice's death. He was the 12-year-old who was shot down mercilessly within 2 seconds, given, you know, in an open carry state, Ohio, given no chance to surrender. The police could have parked at a distance, given him chance to surrender. They did not.
Hell, he had a toy gun. They could have just tackled him.
He had a toy gun, which was related in the phone call to the police. But I was talking to my white friend about this case, and I was asking him, okay, if this was your son, if this was your brother or your dad, would the police actions be justified? Because he was making the case that the police actions were justified in this case. And he had a great difficulty in saying that, yes, if it was my kid, the police actions were justified. Mm-hmm. He had great difficulty saying that. And that is the problem. We aren't holding, you know, the black people to the same standards we hold ourselves and our children. So we have to reframe.
Which is by design.
Yeah, exactly. That's, you know, that is white denial. That's white delusion. Mm-hmm. That's everything. So we have to change those conversations. And after we change the conversations, we have to start working towards public policies that abolish poverty. Right? Because poverty right now is the axis around which all of these racist myths are turning.
Well, I don't think you can abolish poverty.
I have to disagree with you there, but that's a view.
I think they're going to be poor people. As many poor people, maybe not. But I do believe that there are some changes that can be made to level the playing field.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because I think everybody should work hard to get whatever they want in life. I believe that. I believe in the American dream as it used to be. But I still believe that it's about leveling that playing ground and not necessarily about changing poverty, because you're going to have some people that still ain't going to do nothing.
Sure.
I'm just saying.
Sure. My point is that we, you know, need to have, you know, people who are working, you know, 40 hours a week should not be living in poverty. They should have wages that are strong enough, et cetera. But, you know, that's a whole different conversation on how to end poverty or whether we can do it. But my point is,
I'm a great debater. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, you are. If we have people who see black poverty as a sign of laziness and see disproportionate black crime, which comes from poverty, no surprise there. They see that as something wrong with black people. If educational outcomes and differences in outcomes are rooted in poor neighborhoods and poor schools, if we can change poverty, we can lessen racism.
But that's just what you got in office, those who don't want to change that site.
Well,
we have a caller on the air. State your name and what part of town you're calling from.
My name is Laura Bryant, and I'm calling from Independence, Missouri.
Good morning.
Good morning, Laura.
This is an awesome conversation you guys are having. And I would just like to add that on the subject of poverty, I just finished reading Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. And he said the opposite of poverty is justice. And until we have justice across the board, we are going to have poverty in extended racism. But as an educator, I literally retired early because each time race became an issue in predominantly black schools, no one wanted to discuss it. White people, black people, they they want to confine Black history to 1 month out of the year. Mm-hmm. And when I suggested that it be incorporated, because we have a rich history in math, science, I mean, you would have thought I wanted to burn the building down. It is very difficult as an educator to talk about race to our children. It's painful. Some of them have no idea of what our real history is. They think we started as slaves.
Hmm. And at good points.
Unfortunately, Black history is not being taught in the school. I come from California, and I went to Cal State. And
ma'am, can you make your story really quick?
We're
at our last few minutes, and we really want to get another caller on.
All right. Anyway, when I moved here, none of my classes in Pan-American or African-American studies even transferred when I went to school here. When you go into the public schools, you see 80 to 90% white teachers who refuse to acknowledge Black history and racism. Thank you.
All right. Hey, yeah, good comments there. And thank you for calling in, Laura. So there's a school teacher, and I believe she's probably a person of color. That's what I got from the comment she made. And she's basically saying, like, you know, we don't value this diversity enough. And, you know, her studies, you know, were not really accepted. But that's the type of teachers that we need, is people who know about, you know, our whole history, African-American history, the history of this country as it really happened, that sort of thing.
There's a lot of teachers that know the history. The curriculum doesn't allow for it to be taught.
Right, and that's huge.
But
right.
I want to ask this question before we take that caller, and it's about your chapter two, and it says, what is your take in the book on why the Civil War happened? Because there's a great discrepancy about why the Civil War happened.
Right. Well, my book features a great quote from the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, that said, "Our new nation is founded on the belief that the white man is superior to the black man, that slavery is the black man's normal and natural condition." And so if you look at what the leadership of the Confederacy was saying, if you look at the person who created the original battle flag of the Confederacy, it wasn't just the red with the bars, right? Mm-hmm. But it was that in the corner of a white flag originally. And that whiteness was to represent, well, the superiority of white people.
So do you think it had any, that's a symbolic reason.
Right.
Do you think it had anything, does your book mention anything about the economics of slaves and what the slaves provided in capital?
Sure, yes, absolutely. I mean, slavery was free labor.
Because
labor.
Really what the fight is about? South didn't want to let go of their slaves?
Yeah, I mean, their economy was built on a system of free labor, and the idea that blacks should be equal or free would destroy their source of wealth.
So how far in the depth does the book talk about that, the economics, in this chapter?
In this chapter and others, it's fairly in-depth. Okay. I'll say that.
We have a caller on the air. State your name and what part of town you're calling from.
And you're going to have to be brief, 20 seconds.
Yeah, okay. My name is Malcolm. I'm from Midtown. I just have a quick can you hear me?
Yes, you're there.
You're on the air. Thanks, Malcolm.
Okay. I would just challenge one to think about when this country has ever really presented the American dream to folk of color, to those who are marginalized. When has that American dream ever been presented to you, Khadijah? Because you said you believe in the American dream as it once was. When was that period? Also, I would ask that we really think about poverty as something that can be abolished, racism as something that maybe not so much, because it's a pathological not pathological. I think it's part of the DNA of this country. And unless you abolish the country, I'm not sure if you can abolish racism. But poverty, on the other hand, I'm very optimistic that it's something that we can address on a structural level.
All right. Thanks for calling in this morning, Malcolm. Appreciate
it. Malcolm, I just want to say to you that was a kind of like rhetorical. It wasn't really like me saying I believe in the American dream, but I do believe in dreams, and I am a big dreamer. It is no other reason than I sit in front of you on this radio speaking about racism. If it was not for the dream that I had in me, it may not be an American dream, but I am an American living in America, having my dream come true. So.
All right, quick caller. We got like 10 seconds. Quickly, you're on the air. All right, I guess we didn't have that caller. Listen, we want to thank G.S. Griffin for coming in today and talking about this book, and thank you for writing the book, Garrett.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you're very welcome.
They call you G?
Some call me G, yeah.
Well, toot toot to G.
Yeah, thank you to Khadija Hardaway, and of course, thank you to Brother Kareem for answering the phones today. We thank you all for listening. We had a lot of callers this morning. We really appreciate all of our callers and appreciate you listening every week. We do have a Black Lives Matter representative coming up on a future show. That's coming up in a few weeks. We also have someone from Surge we think we're going to have on the program in April. So keep tuning in every Thursday at 9 o'clock a.m. I'm Keith Washburn. Have a great week.